Chapter 5. No Rational Explanation. Theo Conway had been listening intently to the discussion being fed into his earpiece by the discreet transmitter Ben Taban was wearing. Once he had finished smiling after hearing Henry's funny and irreverent but candid description of his state of mind, he prepared himself to rejoin them. He put the earpiece away into a jacket pocket, made sure his jacket was buttoned, then walked round and tapped on the consulting room door. "Ah, Theo, come in." Henry maintained his pose, but noted to himself that Dr. Taban sounded relieved that Dr. Conway was back. "So, Henry, are you ready for a little more, or have you heard enough for this morning?" "I can be around all day, and Dr. Penn's ready to stay here if needs be," said Dr. Conway. Henry unfolded his arms and nodded. "Carry on. Provided it's not a lecture about human evolution, starting in the Great Rift Valley and finishing with transgenic mice being used to grow replacement human ears in a lab in Cambridge, Cambridshire or Cambridge, Massachusetts, I'm fine. I'm all ears. My own 87% human ears I grew myself on the size of my own head without medical murine assistance." "Too long a timescale and too many episodes to cover. Now, as well as being very flippant and funny, you're obviously a very perceptive, intelligent and well-informed chap, Henry. So maybe just a little more would be helpful. We'd best just stick to the Neanderthals and their relevance to you. With everything that's on the internet, you can read into this yourself. I'm quite sure you will as soon as you get the chance. But we think it's important you hear this stuff and, more to the point, that you hear it from us." Henry raised his eyebrows and nodded silently, smiling. He almost certainly would be doing his own background reading as soon as he could start. "The internet's got everything on Neanderthals, from light entertainment and literature to heavy scientific papers," Dr. Conway continued. "And it seems that every couple of months there's a new discovery, a new development, or a new theory, a new lecture or TV documentary. But a chat over the basics with us would be no bad thing. Whatever the internet does have, it won't necessarily have the answers to the questions I'm sure you want to ask about yourself. I'm not suggesting we'll answer them either, but at least we're here to chat face to face, you know, provide the human touch." "Aha, I only need the mostly human touch," Henry reminded him. "But you're right, it's important to get information and informed opinion rather than just information, isn't it?" "It is, and we're glad you can see it like that. Being enthralled to online opinion isn't a sign of intelligence. I reckon most people your age think they can tap a question into any search engine or talk at some artificially intelligent digital assistant and actually get a simple, straight and what's more correct answer to anything they care to ask. That's when you can find out just how artificial that sort of artificial intelligence can be. It might be pre-digested human knowledge that they get, although there's another term for output that's been digested already, but they'll never get an answer that a real human would give." There's no need to worry about me on that score. Anyway, all I need's an 87% human answer, isn't it?" Dr. Conway laughed and responded in kind. "We'll try to be fully human in what we say, and you can ignore 13% of it. How's that?" "Deal," Henry replied nonchalantly. "Okay, so here's a few interesting things to put the encounters between Neanderthals and anatomically modern humans into context. The oldest Homo sapiens fossils in East Africa were found in Ethiopia. They've been dated at 195,000 years old. But early Homo sapiens-like fossils have also been found in Morocco, and they're 330,000 years old. 100,000-year-old human teeth have been found in a cave in China, which is a long way from East Africa. The biggest surprise was the earliest modern human fossil found outside Africa, at Mizlea in modern Israel. It was dated between 180 and 195,000 years old. So it seems that going right back to our beginnings, there were episodes of human migration, settlement and extirpation. That's to say, they'd move somewhere, get established and then become locally, but not globally, extinct. It seems like they had none of the worries about falling off the edge of a flat earth that we had just a few hundred years ago. Well, being primitive or ignorant or uneducated, or all three at once, obviously isn't as bad as we're told it is. Still, life was obviously hard and precarious back then. It puts getting stressed about low broadband speeds into context, Henry said. It does. Then, somewhere around maybe 70,000 years ago, there was a successful episode of Homo sapiens migration out of East Africa. Dr. Conway continued, they left their home in modern Ethiopia, possibly across what's now the mouth of the Red Sea at the Bab al-Mandab, the Gate of Tears, and onto the Sinai Peninsula. No Moses and no divine intervention that time, just good old low sea levels, we think. As waves go, that's the wave of migration, not the conditions in the Red Sea, it was probably more like a tiny ripple than a tsunami, just a few hundred people more likely. And for the purposes of our discussion, the second significant successful exodus. We believe they moved along what was at that time a fertile coastline and up into Central Asia. Then for some, it was right turn towards Eastern and Southeast Asia and beyond. For others, it was left turn up the Fertile Crescent towards Anatolia and then into Europe and probably on up the Danube and beyond. Either that or left turn again down to the Levant. Well, they did them all, and we're their descendants. Just think about that for a minute. 400 or 500 people becoming 7 odd billion, and rising fast, as you've observed. And when they reached the Levant and first came across their long-lost cousins, the interpopulation trouble started and hasn't stopped, Henry said. Well, in the case of the established Neanderthals they met, not the first encountered between these two human types, but the ones that have left a living legacy. They'd been long lost for 500,000 years. So they weren't just lost. They were lost, they'd been forgotten about, and they were unrecognisable. And, to acknowledge your other observation, what do humans do when they find themselves cheek by jowl with other humans or human-like populations they can't communicate with, that don't look, sound, think or act like them? Dr. Conway asked. Oh, easy. Fight them. Infect them with diseases they have no resistance to, drive them away, colonise their territory, or keep them around but exploit and enslave them. Definitely kill some, if not all of them. Maybe eat a few. And on the margins, or probably in the middle of all that, fornicate with them, generally without their consent. Well, Henry, I'd say that's human nature and human history in a single nutshell. Although I'd add that sexual consent is a philosophy that comes with civilization and enlightenment, so it's most likely not something that's been a feature of human, or should I say hominin, society for most of its existence. It's still not in a lot of places. It certainly won't have bothered these two populations when they encountered each other. As an aside, there's genetic evidence of later Neanderthal-Denisovan interbreeding, so the picture of what human diversity really means is really rather complex and getting more so the more we learn. Ha! And it shows another thing about human behaviour that hasn't changed throughout our evolution, Henry said, before Dr. Conway had the chance. Yes, indeed. Now, over the hundreds of thousands of years head start they'd had in their environment, the Neanderthals had evolved and adapted to it, including developing immunity to the endemic diseases. Well, the new arrivals weren't physically adapted and didn't have the same immunities, but they very likely brought some nasty diseases of their own with them that they did have some immunity to and the Neanderthals didn't. Importantly for their success, they may have had certain other advantageous characteristics. Their cognitive and communications functions may have been more highly developed. Their communities and connections were very probably bigger, certainly more extensive, and they were probably more fertile than the Neanderthals. Perhaps most important for getting established and enduring, though, was that there were just more of them, and they came from a bigger, more diverse gene pool. That made them more adaptable and resilient. But when they interbred, it was the newcomers' offspring who seemed to benefit most from hybrid boost they got from inheriting Neanderthal DNA. Henry was more than a little concerned to hear some of this. He was pleased to see his evident concern was not lost on either of his two visitors. Just remember, Henry, we're talking about the situation 60 or more thousand years ago. The human-born hybrids were the real winners in that melting pot, and we're their direct descendants. And to reach our steady state in DNA, we've also evolved a bit further since then, Dr. Taban said. Except that the Neanderthals, and I can't help recalling that I'm 13% Neanderthal, evolved to extinction, didn't they? Henry replied. Evolving to extinction. Now there's an interesting concept. I must remember that one. Well, actually, it does sort of happen. Species that have evolved to survive in very specific environments often can't evolve rapidly enough to cope with these changes suddenly, so they die out. But the Neanderthals were around for a lot longer than we've been around, and they became extinct over a long time, don't forget. It may have been attributable in part, at least, to the less than benign influences of the newly arrived humans, but not solely, according to current theory. Remember, they coexisted however uneasily it may have been for several thousand years. Puts the timescale and a lot else about the Arab-Israeli conflict into perspective, doesn't it? Yeah, it says a lot about human nature too, Henry said, nodding in agreement. Yeah, right. Well, it seems that the main reason for the Neanderthals' extinction was that there were just too few of them, and that made them vulnerable to adverse influences from climate, the environment, and natural disasters, including competitors. Groups were too isolated, and they became too inbred. At some point, every person became a critical member of the clan and the species, every death leaving a shrinking, increasingly inbred, more vulnerable population. The same thing happened to the final populations of woolly mammoths, and it'll probably be the same for tigers, rhinos, lots more soon. But unlike them, the Neanderthals aren't extinct with no trace left, other than in the fossil record or in skins and hides and horns on trophy hunters' wall, are they? All three of us have bits of their DNA in our genomes, and not necessarily the same bits. As a distinct species, sure, they're extinct, but most modern humans are, to a greater or lesser extent, Neanderthal and Denisovan human hybrids. Some both. Back to your Sergeant Major's wife there. Actually, there were Neanderthals in South Wales, so you might have a point about her. Now, even those of us who have no Neanderthal DNA share a common ancestor with those of us who do. Well, that would be an interesting one to complete on a census form, wouldn't it? Henry suggested with a smirk. He put on a formal BBC announcer's voice and said, "What ethnic heritage do you most identify with? Select from white background, a black background, Asian background, mixed ethnic background. Make up your own background. What species or category do you most consider that you belong to? Select from human, human Neanderthal hybrid, human Denisovan hybrid, human Neanderthal Denisovan hybrid, or any other mixed Homo sapiens extinct Homo hominin hybrid. Please give relevant species specific DNA and percentages if known." Who'd have thought identity politics could be such fun? And, Henry, just think about the future flu pandemic survivors, added Dr. Taban, in the same spirit of lightheartedness. We'd presumably want to know precisely what species, that single and plural, we were preserving in the hybrid mix. What an irony it would be that the Neanderthals died out only to be resurrected 35,000 years later because they're better adapted to survive in a disease that's likely to be contracted from battery-farmed Asian chickens. So, Henry, continued Dr. Conway, the real nub of the issue is this interbreeding. We can say for sure that it occurred. In the beginning, it might have been Neanderthals preying on the new arrivals. Over time, it might have been the other way around, who knows. It doesn't seem likely that there were any harmonious, mixed hominin population equivalents of multi-ethnic communities roaming around colonising Europe and Asia. There were just too few people around, and they lived in small, isolated and at times highly inbred groups. Violence motivated by self-preservation would have been the common language. I can't see there being rational interpopulation dialogue. Maybe it was something like bagging trophy wives in the tribal booty sense, or hit-and-run encounters with the interspecies intercourse between the hitting and the running. There's nothing like a bit of new blood to perk up a small gene pool, is there? But it's not as if it's that long since it's been happening here. "Still happening in our valley," said Henry, in his most contrived country yokel accent. I can imagine. Now, what's intriguing is that despite not far off 500,000 years separated evolution, it was possible that these intimate events produced fertile offspring, Dr. Conway continued. Often, you see, cross-species hybrids are infertile. The best-known example is that horses crossed with donkeys produce sterile mules and hinnies. That's assuming natural interbreeding is even physically practical. That's not always the case, is it? I mean, think about specialised and non-compatible breeding parts and all that. Anyway, fertile offspring can produce their own fertile offspring. That way, fertile hybrids mating successfully with other fertile hybrids maintain the mixed DNA. And that, in the most simplistic terms, is the rational explanation why all of us have still got a little bit of Neanderthal DNA in among the majority of our human DNA. Or, if you're a Neanderthalophile or a self-identifying Neanderthal, that's why there's lots of human DNA in among the little bit of precious Neanderthal DNA at the core of your being. We've reached steady state with our Neanderthal and Denisovan DNA, but now there are no other human species around to get any hybrid boost from, Dr. Taban added. So it's very probable in future that the limits of human performance are likely only to be extended by people who've been genetically re-engineered somehow. No unmodified person who's evolved naturally looks likely to do the 100 metres in much under 8 seconds or a marathon in under an hour and a half anytime soon. But with gene manipulation over several generations, who knows? Are there any downsides to having the Neanderthal DNA I've got? Henry asked. There are some characteristics and conditions we can say with reasonable certainty are attributable to having Neanderthal DNA in the genome. Some of these genes are possibly advantageous, others are possibly deleterious, nothing extreme either way. Others are simply mysterious, but in your case, Henry, said Dr. Conway, nobody can say. Okay, so I've heard parts one and two of your so-called story now, and having heard it, I'm much better informed, but still none the wiser. Is there any rational explanation for why my DNA is like it is? Dr. Taban replied, shaking his head. No.